Welcome to In the Social, a podcast of conversations on how the wider world is represented in our families' educational lives. We are a collection of parents from varied lifestyles, backgrounds, and ethnicities dedicated to consensual living, social justice, and lifelong self-directed learning. You can find us on Twitter at In the Social Pod and find us on Facebook at In the Social Pod. We're going to start today by asking the question, what was your first favorite game? Should I start over?
My name is Shannon. I'm the parent of a 5 and an 8-year-old. And my first favorite board game is a version of life my sister and I made up, where every time you passed a payday square, you had to stop and play a round of payday. And then whatever money you got from payday was transferred back to the life game.
I'm Alan. I'm also the parent of a 5-year-old and an 8-year-old. They are different than Shannon's. My favorite game growing up was Lie, Cheat, and Steal, which was the game of political power. It was a dice and move game like Monopoly, where you navigated around the board, but there were some differences. Occasionally, you went into the world of business and politics to get money and votes. You needed 500 votes to win, but other people could go to the press and blackmail you for votes.
So I'm Jennifer, and my kids are 5, 7, and 9. And I'm going to vary a little bit because my favorite games when I was a kid was board games, Boggle and Scrabble. I loved adding up those points and crushing those opponents that way.
I'm Mandy, and I am the mother of 5 kids, ages 14, 12, 9, 6, and almost 3. I did not come from a gaming family. My siblings are all much older, so I was pretty much lucky if I could get one of my older brothers to play Stratego or Risk or chess with me. It didn't happen a lot, so it's probably a different background than some of the others. But I had this grand idea that when we had kids, we would have these great big family game nights, and it would be all wonderful. And then we had kids. And it wasn't wonderful. It was awful. And I hated the games. And really, I think I would have preferred bashing my head against the wall than playing some of these games. And we would buy new games that people said, oh, you've got to try this. And it was awful. And my visions of game night were kind of dashed until one day my husband came home all excited and he had a game with him. And one of his coworkers, who was into a board gaming club, had brought in a board game and started a club at work over lunchtime. And that completely changed our lives. It opened us up to an entirely different world of board games. And from then on, board games were awesome.
What was the board game, Mandy?
I don't even remember what it was. I have no idea. But then we started looking into... I know Board Game Geeks has been a big resource for us, but then just reading up on games and after we kind of had an idea of what we liked, it was much easier. And now we have kind of an extensive board game collection. So what types of games do you guys like to play as with your families?
Well, I also grew up playing all of, you know, Monopoly and Life and Boggle and all of those things. And I loved them. And I still, you know, I still love them. Just it's harder to find people to play them with because they kind of bore my kids and they kind of bore my friends who have all moved on to the better board games. But I also really enjoy all of the fantastic board games that you can get after the sort of big European board gaming renaissance. My favorite games are the co-op styles, and it just so happens that that works really well for my oldest. She has a bit of a problem losing, so any game where we can all be working together towards a common goal is really good.
We have that too. My kids don't mind competition, but a lot of our friends really don't handle it. So we try and really search for ones where we have to work together. That way everybody gets to play, but nobody gets too far ahead and gets frustrated and just dumps it.
With my kids, I do play a lot of chess because it's easy to do one-on-one, and my kids enjoy that. But again, there is the difficulty with losing, so we don't always finish the game. with chess for that reason. Also attention spans. But other than that, we've been playing a lot of the drafting card games because they're really fast games and really easy for the kids to do. And many of the cards don't rely on words. They rely on symbols. So the kids who can't read yet can really get into that.
We tend to play a variety of games. Most of our family likes strategy-based games. Chance-based games are a little bit easier for younger kids. What we've found is that the whole age consideration on games, we can pretty much just throw out. Because with our younger kids, we either team up and have someone older with someone younger, or we kind of vary the rules a little bit to help them. But it really hasn't been a problem for us. What have you guys found?
That's also been my experience. I've been playing games with younger kids for a very long time because I was a babysitter as a teenager, and then I became a nanny in my late teens and early 20s. And the very first homeschooling family that I ever worked with, I started playing D&D with their kids. And I think, let's see, they had a 3-year-old, a 6-year-old, and a 9-year-old. And it turns out that we were playing, they had a copy of D&D they found, like the original D&D they found at a thrift store. And so I basically just threw out half the rules and introduced them to sort of the basics of role playing and paying attention to stats and the die rolls. But we ignored all of the THACO and anything that involves statistics. And for the younger one, he just wanted to be a dragon. So, well, that's fine. He can be a dragon and rampage through the game, and it doesn't really change much of anything. So that's how we kind of operate. It, you know, a game can still be fun for competitive adults or older children, and expand to involve a small person who wants to play on their own or wants to help somebody but doesn't understand all the rules. Like, one of my favorite games to play with very little kids is Ticket to Ride. And it's pretty easy to adjust that for a non-reading kid because the train cards are all colored. You don't have to read to see them. And as long as you are willing to all work together to help the youngest person understand and reach their goals, then that, like, that's the only hurdle to them enjoying that game. So, you know, if you can look at a 3-year-old's destination cards and Ticket to Ride and help them figure out how to get there without, you know, blocking them immediately, then you're good.
I found with Ticket to Ride as well that it was relatively easy to adjust it because I'm usually playing one adult and several kids. And so with that one, I just started with one long destination card that they were, and whoever completed it first won instead of looking at points at all, and then slowly developing more destinations and going for that way.
And I think a Ticket to Ride is a really good, what I consider, gateway game. We've given it as a gift several times. And once people play that game, they're like, oh, wow, this is a completely different style. What else is there? Mm-hmm. Some of the other commonly found games that you can get readily at, like, Target are Carcassonne, which has a million expansions, it seems like. Mm-hmm. Dominion. Can you get Dominion at Target yet? I think you can.
I didn't see it there, but...
Maybe not. But I've seen it other places, and it's a card deck building game. So different than, like, the Tile Lane or some of the other games.
I did see a lot of Settlers of Catan last time we were over there, though.
And there are lots of different of those now, too. Settlers of Catan is the reason I almost failed out of college.
We just have the Catan Junior one so far, because we really were not advanced in our gameplay at all when we started this. It was just basically our kids decided they really liked playing games. And so we needed games that were quick and easy to introduce when my partner and I were not game-minded that way. So a lot of our stuff is considered kid games, but we played it on our own just to get it nailed down before we could play with our kids.
Right.
Go ahead.
Sorry. I think Settlers of Catan is another great example of games that can be played by younger kids. I know my 2-year-old loves to play it, and we really don't alter the rules much for her at all.
What I was going to say is a lot of the games that I'm getting recently are those that I search through the games for the ones with simpler dynamics that are still complex and interesting for adults. So, like, I'm not going into the family game room to find the games. I'm going into the rest of the game store and sorting through to find which ones have the simple enough mechanics that are really, really elegant in their gameplay. So some of those that I've been playing recently, Sheepland is a great one. Dragonwood is good. Sushi Go, which is a card, another card drafting game like Fairy Tale, which my kids really love. And so they're all games that are written for adults, but are great for kids.
Oh, I found that the Forbidden Island and Forbidden Desert, even though it seems like a really involved game, because the gameplay is very straightforward, it takes a lot of strategy and working together. But because the rules are so straightforward, it's easy to just jump in with any age that I've worked with. Because they don't have to necessarily read. I mean, once we figured out the matching cards, you can look by pictures and move the tile as necessary. So
those are fast games too. So you're not sitting down to a 2 or 3 hour game.
And they work well with reluctant relatives too, older relatives who are like, oh, I don't like games, because it's quick and it's cooperative and it's interesting. Yeah. So I've also found that, let's see, King of Tokyo and Castle Panic are really good with kids, because especially the ones who are more inclined towards physical movement, they both involve kind of knocking things over and smashing things while they're still board games. And so, yeah, those are ones that are really popular with my 5-year-old.
Yeah. We just played a game of Castle Panic with a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old and a 7-year-old yesterday.
And as we've kind of continued on in our board game journey, we found certain game manufacturers and even designers that we tend to really like, just because of the style or the replayability. Replayability has been a really big thing for us, because some of these games are expensive.
Oh, and
you don't go out to eat and you don't do this and you don't do that, but you invest in the game because you know you're going to get to play that over and over again, and it's not going to get boring.
We have found that the Game Right Games, which is the Forbidden Desert and Island, but they also have this whole slew of card games. For some reason, I have really good luck finding them at the thrift store.
Oh, really?
And because their pieces are so simplistic. I mean, you can list exactly what there is, and I can scan through it quickly to see if all the pieces are there. And I already know that anything with the Game Right tag, because we already like most of their games, I'm probably doing all right picking them out. But I think every other time I go, I manage to find a new card or board game for about $2 to $5. And it's just because I know what label I'm looking for to really pay attention to.
I went in this morning and tried to see what our top game manufacturers were, just based off of volume. And we have a lot of Z-Man games, Hans and Gluck. We have a lot of those. Queen games. We also have Rio Grande games, makes a lot of good games. Days of Wonder, Asmodee. I'm trying to think of some of the others.
And Days of Wonder and Asmodee tend to make really beautifully made games. Like, the pieces are nice. Yeah. And the boxes are great too. Like, there's some place to put everything.
That's an important one too, is how much space those boxes take up, or how well the boxes are going to live.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We were already talking about buying new Sushi Go just so that we could have the tin, because the box gets torn up. It's that double box.
Yeah. The tin's nice.
So yeah, that's another one of those investment things that you have to consider. Like, sure, I can get the game for $8, but the box will tear in like 4 games. So maybe I should fork out for the $15 tin.
Yeah. Speaking of Asmodee, they're one of my new favorites. I hadn't heard of them before, I think, 2 years ago, I guess. And then there's Takenono and what's the one? What's the one where you're taking a journey? I forget the name of that. Oh, gosh. anyway, they've made two really interesting games that they're not cooperative, and you're also not really combative. It's going to drive me crazy. Takenono, you're feeding pandas and building and growing
bamboo.
Thank you. And then in the other one, which I really wish I could remember the name of, you are taking a trip through Japan, and you're stopping at spas and meeting people along the way.
Oh, doesn't that start with a T?
Yes. What is it called?
Like talking.
Yeah. So, and eating, you're eating a lot in that game. And then you win points based on how good of a journey you had. So like, those are really interesting to me. The designer of Antoine Bauza also made, the designer of Takenono, Antoine Bauza, also made Seven Wonders, which my kids aren't quite ready for, but I'm really waiting for them to be able to.
That is a favorite in our house.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's definitely on our wish list.
Yeah.
Something I've noticed playing games, like my 12-year-old, for example, she's very peaceful. She's the moderator. She, you know, when she was 5, she didn't even want to listen to Percy Jackson because of the fighting. But you put her in a game, and she will go cutthroat. So if you play a military on her, that's it. You're dead. She's going to go after you. And it's an aspect of her personality that comes out in games, but not in other parts of her life, which I find a little interesting.
That is interesting.
I'm trying to think of some of our favorites. I asked my 14-year-old this question this morning, and he reminded me that his favorite games are Mutor and Veritor. I don't know if you guys have played those. They're card games.
No.
They're German card games, and I don't know if you can get them right now. They tend to go out of production for long periods of time, but they're very interesting because you never know what side the rest of the players are on. That's another one where my 12-year-old will go after and kill people, mm-hmm. but only after she's been attacked.
I think it's great how there's basically a game for any personality, any interest that you want. So I have a brother who's really into history, so they enjoy playing timeline and chronology with us. Which is harder for the kids because they don't have all those history dates in their head, but they just marvel at the people who do. So they sit there and play with us. And so they're going to be getting some of that information at the same time. And I have other siblings who hate playing just about any game. So you can kind of trick them in a quick card game, even if it's something as simple as Uno or going on a Sushi Go or Too Many Monkeys.
Yeah. Oh, and for a very long time, my friends and I have been playing Quiddler. Basically, whenever a group of 3 or more people are sitting around without anything to do for a while, you can play Quiddler. And you're supposed to play it for, I think, 10 rounds, and you're supposed to keep score. But we basically just, like, play until something better comes along to do. And you make, it's a cross between, like, Rummy and Scrabble. And you have these cards with letters on them, and you can take it seriously or you can take it not very seriously. And like I said, you can stop whenever you want. One of my favorite games to pull out when there's a large group of people over, and especially with small children, are the games where it doesn't matter how many people are playing and for how long people are playing. There's a lot of very popular party card games that have been popping up lately that fit in that style, even though they have rules for winning and, you know, an end game condition, like apples to apples. You can just deal out however many hands you need every round, and you can stop whenever. And Quiddler.
A similar game like that is Flux, and they have a bunch of different versions. But you can jump in or jump out whenever, and it's constantly changing. And it's one of those games that we have available anytime we have people over because it's so straightforward. Anyone who's never played before can just jump in and play. And I think games can be a good opening for meeting people. We've recently moved, and we started having people over for our homeschool group. And some of the older kids were just kind of standing around. And I suggested to one of my kids that they ask if the others wanted to play a game. And that just broke the ice right there. And everyone played games for the rest of the day.
Yeah, there's a number of game stores in Seattle where I live, where they have, you know, they have tables and people can play games. And because we homeschool, and there's a pretty big homeschooling community here, most of them have at least one day a week where there's a group of homeschoolers that get together and try out games in a store. And the stores are really welcoming. So it's really great to like have that resource. Try something new, meet people.
Those stores seem to be popping up more and more across the country. And it's a great way to try games before you buy them, because it is an investment for many of these games. I know some of the ones I've been to have been, they charge like $1 to play them. Others don't charge anything. So it's pretty affordable to go out and try something before you make an investment.
A lot of the ones here have food. So
yeah,
that's how they make their money.
My favorite one has a restaurant attached to it. So you can go into the restaurant and then you can go into the game store and borrow a game and go play in the restaurant and then bring it back.
So what do we all think of educational games?
Man, way to suck the fun out of something.
Well, it really depends on the game.
Yeah, but it seems like so often people take this great idea of, oh, they like playing games. Let's make it educational. And then we've got kids. I mean, I know my kids love playing. It's not a board game, but they play a online game that includes math and they love it. And that's great. But I just think that when I sit down to play a game with my family, I don't necessarily need to be practicing multiplication tables. I just want to play and they'll get a different kind of experience, a different kind of education from playing the video games than they would from, or not video games, table games, than they would from educational games.
And I think it's the separation of to learn, you must be taught such and such, rather than to learn, you have to experience and go with it and find out. Because just about any game out there is going to teach you something. You're going to learn something from it. Even if it's not from the game itself, but from the conversations going on based off of that game, your kids are learning. You are learning.
So I ended up teaching a simple math games class at the community center for a homeschool co-op for a while. And I mean, I really went in and I focused and I found lots of simple two-player paper pencil games that you could do that had complex concepts, most of them in the game theory realm, because that's what I was looking for. But they had math involved, but I didn't want to just have games that were practice your multiplication tables. I wanted to have games where you were making simple choices that had complex impacts on the game so that there was actually a strategy that you were having to do. I always start with NIM, which is a series of games where you have either one or two or three piles of chips and you take either a certain number of tiles up to a certain number of tiles out each turn, or you have some other rule limiting how many tiles you take out and you want to be the last person to take out. And the very simple game is a fixed game like tic-tac-toe, where if you know the winning strategy, the second player will always win. But as you make the rules a little bit more complex, it becomes much more strategic about thinking about it and harder to figure out what that winning strategy is.
That's kind of the same principle as Moncala, isn't it? I mean, on a larger scale. Yeah. What were you saying,
Jennifer? I think it's one of those problems that we hit a lot in our, I mean, it's not just games that we have that issue with. It's that whole lifelong self-directed learning.
Right.
That Mandy was talking about, that you have to be taught something in order to learn something. And it ignores the inherent value of just doing a thing as an educational experience. So when we try to enforce this sort of specific educational bracket on games that we play, we forget that there's always an educational value in things that you do.
Mm-hmm.
So many games have logic or strategy or spatial reasoning built in already that you're already practicing these skills, but you don't realize it. And when you try to take that organic portion out and force it into something that it wasn't meant to be, I think you actually lose a lot of the educational value of playing.
Yeah, I know my kids get burned out faster on the well-intentioned games that say educational. They seem to get burned out faster on it. They just aren't as interested. They get past the what they need to learn for that game, and then they lose interest.
Yeah.
But the games where you're constantly developing different strategies, different approaches, learning new parts of understanding, like learning more advanced ideas about each one, are the ones that they keep going back to time and time again.
And it comes back to design. I mean, a lot of the educational games are simple, follow the path, Monopoly or Candyland style games with an educational film over them, as opposed to having that complex gameplay where you're strategizing. And that's what frustrates me most about most educational games isn't so much the fact it's an educational game. That's okay, I guess. But it's the fact that the game mechanics are so simple that the game isn't interesting beyond the educational content.
My spouse refers to those as how to play games. That they're basic. What the Candyland and what those very simple games are teaching you is the basics of game mechanics. When he was a kid, he used to play Monopoly by himself, just like over and over and over again until he got the hang of how like that worked. Because I guess he really likes to understand how things work. So
I have been accused of breaking games a lot because we get a new game and I want to explore it to its fullest and figure out the mechanics behind it. And then I break games. Not physically, but.
Right. Then you know
we have that problem. We have that problem with Catan. Like my husband and I, we would want to play it more, but the people we play it with would be like my brother, but his friends played it until he couldn't handle playing it anymore. So now we'd have nobody to play it with because he's so burned out because his friends wanted to play from every separate little angle and every little expansion. And he's like, I played this game for 3 months straight. I'm not playing it anymore.
Well, that was college. I played Settlers of Catan maybe 20 hours a day for weeks. It was still fun.
Mandy, tell your family to just do what I do, which is my goal whenever I'm playing against my spouse is to make him lose. If I know I'm not going to win a game, then my goal is to try and keep him from winning. And if I keep him from winning, then I've won, regardless of whether or not I've actually won. Because that's how he plays. He learns how to play the game so well that I have no chance. So yeah.
If I can't win, nobody can win.
No, just not him. I'll let anybody else. I'm fine with that.
And my husband and I tend to do that to each other just so that we're not doing that to the kids.
Right.
Because if you're going to have to make it harder for someone, we're going to go after each other than making it hard for, you know, like the 9-year-old.
Right. But just tell the kids to gang up on you, you know.
And it's not that I make them play the same game over and over. It's just I tend to look at the strategy and my husband will get a new game. And he's like, you broke it, didn't you? I'm sorry. So then I'm whispering little hints to the kids.
Yeah.
Hello, sell high.
My spouse bought me this new game for Christmas, and it's a 2-player game, and the whole instructions are written in story. And so we played the first round of it, and then the rules slightly changed for the second round. And after we finished, he went online and found the rules written out in plain text, and he's like, oh, we cheated. We have to go back and replay this. I'm like, we didn't cheat. We just didn't understand the rules because of how they were written. It's totally different. We can replay the game and do it right. It's okay. I'll let you.
There are some design. One of our absolutely favorite game designers is Yu Rosenberg. Mm-hmm. Absolutely wonderful games. Horrible at writing instructions.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Yeah, there's so many games out there that they could have done a much better job writing those instructions.
And that's
because the way they're written, there's debatable rules and corners and all of that easily could have been cleared up with a good editing.
And that's
I think we played through Pandemic about 4 times before we figured out what the rules actually were.
If you're ever looking at the instructions on a new game and you don't know what to do, go online. Somebody has figured it out for you. You don't have to.
My kids love doing that. When they get a new game, they'll go and search and see if Tabletop has already played it, and they'll sit there and watch the whole video first.
Oh, nice.
Just to get the basic idea.
We've actually gotten a bunch of games because my daughter watched a Tabletop and was like, I want that game.
And that's a great suggestion. My family, we get a new game and everyone hands me the directions. They're like, okay, figure it out, and then we'll play it. But I like that idea. Go look online. Figure it out. Play it.
So I'm where sure online do you look? Other than Tabletop, where online do people look?
Well, sometimes the website for the game company will have some tutorials. I know that's true with Mice and Mystics. They have video tutorials for the rules. But I was just looking on Board Game Geek at Fairy Tale, because Fairy Tale is such a generic name, and I wanted to be more specific with the title. So it's Fairy Tale, A New Story. But there's people that blog beginner's guides to blank, 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 and run out the rules in a short blog post.
And then Board Game Geek, we found as a really great resource for ratings on games. For us, we found that anything that doesn't rate at least a 7 really isn't well done, or at least not to our standards. But there's a lot of good information on there so that you can read up about a game before buying it. And sometimes they'll even tell you who has the cheapest price.
That's cool. My spouse listens to a gaming podcast called In the Dice Tower, and he says they're constantly referencing one time when they did a rundown of family games, but he hasn't come across it yet, so I can't give you the actual episode title. Most of it is just sort of general gaming, which, as we've said, is, you know, you can play a lot of general games for kids, but it's not definitely not a podcast to listen to with your kids. Unless you have older kids, or, you know, I don't know, depending on your kids, I guess.
I also like going, when we talked about going to game stores, I like when there's other people there and seeing what they're playing and hearing what they actually think about it. That one's always fun, because almost every time I've walked in, they're playing something that I've never actually seen played before. Mm-hmm. So it's helpful to make that connection, especially in person, even if it's a little hard to be social with people at a game store. So that's kind of fun, but...
Until you start becoming a regular.
Yeah.
I went to a new game store before Christmas this year, and the employees had put little stickers on the games they tried. And so there was like 1 to 3 smiley faces on different games, depending on how much they liked things. You know, and a bunch of games didn't have any stickers on them because I'm sure they hadn't managed to try all of them. But it was cool to see, like, oh, this is a brand new game that hasn't been reviewed online yet, and it has a smiley face sticker, so that's a good sign.
That is helpful.
Yeah.
We found one of our favorite games that way, though, and it's silly. It's a silly little dice game. It's just called Dalek Dice, like Doctor Who, Dalek Dice. And it was so easy to start up with the kids. It was so easy to follow along and do it, and I was amazed because I'd never heard of it, never thought to go get it. But it's just because we walked into the game store and somebody was playing it. It helps that it was Doctor Who, because I'd probably buy it anyways. But the game itself was actually a lot of fun. And it's kind of like a Yahtzee style. I mean, dice games kind of all tend to be that way. But it was very nice to see somebody playing it and know that I wasn't just buying it because it was Doctor Who.
Right.
I was going to say, that's sort of how I've been able to see, like, the X-Wings thing. Because I see people playing that and I talk to them. But I've never actually played it, and probably won't, because any game that you have to collect so many different pieces to play from different sets is out of my willingness to buy.
Right.
Yeah, some games get kind of intimidating that way, with miniature games.
Well, and even things like Smash Up, which is a fun game, but in order to play it, you have to buy all those different expansion packs to get enough cards to make it interesting.
Yeah.
So...
And then you have questions like, how many bases do you put out?
Sometimes those expansions can be difficult. You have to think about that as part of your investment in the game.
Right.
Is the main game going to be enough for those that I expect to be playing with? Mm-hmm. One of the ones we had a hard time with was Timeline, because each genre has its own game. And it's not a very expensive one, but basically, like, all the music and entertainment is one tin. All the science is another tin. So we had to buy multiple tins in order to have enough variation of questions that everybody could enjoy the game.
Yeah.
So we went from this is just a $10 card game to spending like $40 or $50 to get a really good.
And you know, the company's going, cha-ching.
Yeah.
I made it big because I've got this game that's infinitely expandable and people are going to want all the expansions.
Although, yeah. If you do want Timeline and you only want to buy one copy, they do have a set called Diversity. And it was funny when I was looking at the online reviews for it. The first one I saw was like, I was worried that this was going to be about different diverse cultures. And fortunately, it was just regular, normal history and science and music and everything all mixed together. And I was
actually kind of disappointing.
I know. I was so disappointed. I was like, Dad, I was hoping for actual diversity. But it's a small selection of all of the topics that when they came out with the base line that they put together. So it doesn't have all of the different categories that they now have, but it does have, you know, a little bit of everything. So
that's helpful.
And you know, the whole game itself is actually fairly diverse. I mean, they do tend to lean towards Western civilization, but they have stuff from multiple civilizations represented in that game. So
are there game topics we haven't addressed yet?
Let's see.
I think we've hit most of the main points.
Yeah. One thing I would mention is if you end up with a list of games that you want, which is really easy to do, every year Amazon has a big game day sale. Does anybody remember when that happens?
Nope.
It's like September or something.
Somewhere in there.
Yeah, it's in the fall. So, you know, it always shows up on my Facebook feed, but
it always shows up on my feed, but I usually get onto the website after all the games I'm looking for are sold out.
Right. Yeah.
That always happens to me.
I can end up finding one thing we're looking for. And they do tend to lean heavily, or at least by the time I get there, they're leaning heavily in the direction of Candyland and Millbourne's and I don't know, all those things. So yeah.
A lot of the board game websites often have better prices than Amazon. So if you're ordering a large order, like they'll probably have free shipping over $100 or $150. That's often a better way to go than Amazon. But if you're just ordering one game, then Amazon often wins out.
That's true. All right. Does anybody have any final thoughts?
Or you can just go volunteer at a game store and get gift cards.
Wait, that works? I'm on that.
That's what I've been doing.
I had no idea. What do you do at the game store?
I DM.
Oh.
So I've been DMing D&D, and I got a 30-book game card for a month of DMing. And I mean, it's well under minimum wage. But
you're playing.
But I'm playing and having fun.
That's awesome.
I think that's everything then.
All right. Yep. Thank you for joining us at In the Social Pod. You can find us on Twitter at In the Social Pod or on Facebook at In the Social Pod. Just search for us. We will include a list of the games and publishers mentioned here in the show notes. Our next podcast will cover gender-neutral parenting. In the meantime, we would love to hear from you. How do games enrich your lives? What's your family's favorite game? We look forward to hearing from you. Bye.